But soon he will learn manners. I will torture his body so that his soul learns to be humble.
Okay, he know we just talking here, right? I mean, we just getting people interested in
Cage Against the Machine.
Cage Cousins, what's good? Sweet NBA. About to get into my cool down from UFC 246. McGregor versus Cerrone, if you could call it that. Thanks for the feedback. Got a lot of great messages and a lot of comments after we did the posts. I was really happy to sort of like give up a couple more tips. I'd love to hear how you guys are enjoying the dietary stuff as well as the weight loss. I hope that helps and we'll keep that up. A lot of thoughts given, you know, the fight. One of the things that's really interesting is just season upon season, what we try to do is, you know, train through the week, recover through the week. Four of those weeks add up and you get to the big pay-per-view and trying to keep that same rhythm. So I'm hoping that your work week and your school week and your family life is similar, where you feel like you're training through it. I've been reading a lot of incredible books that make me think about this stuff more and more. The early prelims, I'm going to be honest, I should have been able to watch, but I wasn't able to. I was setting up a fight party at my martial arts school, and one of our sort of, you know, the guy who's like maybe the oldest student, along with myself, who've been there the longest, so he's not the youngest person either, so I had to kind of go over there and make sure the fight was all set up and do that, and, you know, taking care of our community is important. So I missed the Kimura versus Leddit fight. And I could tell by the decision by Kimura. I mean, it's interesting. I don't think that Leddit actually was there to win, and no fault of his own, right? I mean, I feel like they booked him one day to get a highlight reel for Yanni, and then they pushed Yanni, and they pushed him too fast, obviously. Hopefully they've learned not to sleep on Corey Anderson anymore. I actually expected Kimura to win by knockout. So it shows that either, you know, we'll have to see what happens with Kimura. I actually saw that he was one of the first people traded out of my fantasy league after the fight was over. So maybe he underperformed as well. I'll have to go back and like look at that fight a little bit and see. Other interesting early prelim that I missed was Mazo versus Aldrich. That was really Aldrich's fight to lose. You know, she's got a name and a little bit of a push. But Mazo made it happen. But again, another decision, right? So a score-based decision. So a battle of attrition that turned out the way it did. So those were the early prelims. Right as I sort of turned on and tuned in and got everything going with the prelims. And for a minute there, you know, I got to say, like, I'm really happy with this year and the year that happened in terms of the USC programming and the ESPN app. But I still think the fact that to watch early prelims and stuff, I got to go into, watch it on Fox 2 or Fox Sports 2 and have an app to do that. And it's two different subscriptions. And maybe I'm just going to go a little savage on this, but I'm kind of not trying to do multiple subscriptions. I'm kind of really not feeling that. That's just like the draining the vital lifeblood of one's bank account. We don't need all that. I just don't understand fundamentally. I just feel like that is something that the powers that be at the UFC could do a much better service for their customer base by keeping it all under one roof and making that happen. So where you open one app and you get to see everything. Because I know other people all the time who want to start watching these fights and they're signing up and they still don't get it. I mean, it's still a hard pill to swallow that you sign up for this monthly 1 year ESPN Plus and then you have to buy a pay-per-view on top of that. Much less that now if you want to watch an early prelim, you got to have a separate app and it's, you know, I'm wondering, is that bringing people in or is it just setting up more channels to make people find excuses not to tune in and understand the sport? And that's what we're really doing here, you know, aside from sort of evangelizing and teaching people how to watch the fights, we want to get people to be inspired by what they're seeing at the fight so it comes into their daily lives. And those daily lives are, like, improving. So when I tuned in to the first prelims, it was Drew Dober versus Hak Parass, which I guess my post on Instagram brought in a bunch of Hak Parass's audience. You know, it's kind of ill where we live nowadays. And 2020, you know, where you could put out a video and speak your mind and speak your truth and somebody across the world who barely speaks your language can find some meaning in it and say, you know what, I want to come back for these videos. I thought that was cool, man. I appreciate that. So if you are tuning into this because you're a Hak Parass fan, cool. I thought he was going to give Dober some problems, and that's just not what happened. Dober bullied him. KO to TKO in the first round. Made it happen. Dober is continuing his rise and his ascent. And he's saying the right things, too. He's got that sort of clean, all-American look, per se, that nice cornflakes and orange juice appeal. But he's saying all the right things. I'll fight anybody who the UFC puts in front of me. You know, I'm going to knock people out. I'm going to be entertaining. I'm here to take a belt. You know, vanilla, no controversy. But certainly won't be hard getting the matchmakers to put him in the right position. The next fight was, even more interesting to me, which was essentially Tim Elliott, versus, Askarov, and I'm probably not even saying that fool's name right. I think it was like Sapkarov. That was really an entertaining fight to me, and I'm going to tell you why for a couple of things. First of all, Elliot, you know, Rogan even made a mention that Elliot's social media, whether it's Twitter or Instagram, is awkward MMA. And his stance, his bounce, his motions, his hand placement, everything was hashtag awkward. I mean, it couldn't be more awkward, but it was effective. It was super effective. You know, I was biased. I look at his opponent and I say, Dagestani combat sambo guy. Oh, he's going to eat this dude for lunch. Not at all. Man, the head slips back and forth. Slip, slip, slip. Elliot just drops a bunch of strikes to the belly. Slip, slip, slip. Soon as the wrestler tries to defend it, oh, look, there's a judo throw. Over and over and over again. Transitions, transitions, ground transitions. I was like, yo, not so awkward. Not so awkward. Maybe perhaps a really great strategy in dealing with the type of sambo wrestling that he was facing. Let's see where his strike goes. I'm definitely intrigued. I was, you know, and I gotta wonder, I feel like, you know, I used to have this joke, when the red mohawk of the welterweight division, right? God, he's on the tip of my tongue. But when he used to bob and weave with that mohawk, it was like it gave somebody such a target, and then he was so good at moving around that. So I wonder if Hardy, when he used to do stuff like that. So I feel like with Tim Elliott, using that mullet was almost a superpower. Like, I don't think his opponent, Soporov or whatever, I don't think he cared. Like, oh, okay, I'm looking at your stupid haircut, right? Because dudes from Dagestan, you know, Eastern European, you know, culturally, ethnically Muslim, sort of like, weird haircut doesn't matter, right? He's already in enemy territory fighting an American, like, whatever. But I feel like the way that the hair moved, it really added to the slips, where he kept baiting shots to his face, and his ability to just slip just a few inches past the jab, just a few inches past those crosses, and then just immediately return. It was built in. I was like, really impressive. It was some really good kickboxing. I'd be curious to see if I could see this level of combat again out of him, because I'm wondering, with that kind of striking, will the next time an opponent happens, will he keep his hands down that low and do that? Will that opponent be looking at that film and say, okay, well, when he slips and does those things, I know to aim a little bit higher, because those hands aren't going to be there to respond. It'd be very interesting to see how this goes from a stylistic. I nerd out on things like that all the time. You know, I was having this conversation recently with somebody. It's irrelevant. But the point is, I think in my early days of training, I thought that it was all about styles. You know, a style defined what made a fight, you know. And obviously, I was in love with my style, so I always wanted to have supremacy over other styles, right? Okay, I do Xing Yi, so that's better than other stuff. Okay, well, then I started learning Dam Doi. Well, that's going to make me better than this. Well, now I'm learning Bagua, and I'm going to use this on that. And now I'm learning Shaolin, and that makes me better than this. And I can counter, you know, Eagle Claw guys with this. And then, you know, I saw the very first UFC, and that kind of shook it up a little bit, you know. That was a very Street Fighter II mentality. Hoist comes in there, shakes it up. You got dudes in there claiming they're masters of ninjutsu. We come to find out they probably have never even fought before in their life. And so the stylistic argument quickly went away. And then also everybody jumped to that chorus line where they were in love with jiu-jitsu. And jiu-jitsu became, Brazilian jiu-jitsu became the dominant style for a good 6-year run. And then it was countered by American wrestling. And then everybody was becoming a wrestler. And then I think there was a rebirth of sort of the Shotokan, Inchin, kind of explosive karate striking. And then that did things for a while. And then I think with the acquisition of Pride into UFC, everybody was in love with Muay Thai because of Anderson. I would say the Diaz brothers really brought boxing back into the play. You know, and now obviously, of course, we're seeing these new styles. So I was always in love with those. But more and more, I've come to find that it's like not really about styles, but fundamentally a few good techniques in succession, and accuracy that can make it happen, right? So if you look at somebody who is just dominant, let's take Khabib, for instance. Fundamentally, how many different types of takedowns have we seen him on his championship run? I mean, when he first came, it was a bunch of suplexes, right? Then Injury City, Injury City, Injury City. When he got really serious and locked it in about look, I'm on the road to this belt, and once I get this belt, I'm here to obliterate McGregor. you know, essentially single legs. Single legs, get on top of you, tie your legs under it. So just a few couple techniques in succession that you know is coming. And so when I come back to Elliot, and what I think is really compelling is his style, just using, again, couple hooks and a great slips, and then being able to, as soon as you close the distance, oh, hi, welcome to my judo throws. Pretty interesting to me. The next fight, hugely controversial decision, hugely. And I had some skin in the game with this. On one level, you have a Sacramento fighter, Andre Feely. Shout out to my boy, Smokey Figs. He's going to hate me for this because he had a post up about that decision. He was like, if anybody thinks that Feely actually lost, message me right now. We can fight in real life. And I wanted to tell him, I think Feely lost, but I'm not interested in fighting you. Versus Sadiq Yusuf. And Sadiq is just as much of a nerd as Andre Feely is. And that's what was really interesting. And I think the real exchanges were when the jab started, Feely's jabs were setting up his leg kicks, which were landing, yes. And there's an argument in here that UFC judging fundamentally still does not really take into account the power of the leg kicks and how effective they are. That was the deciding factor in the Volkanovski Holloway fight. It was, you know, but in this fight, it didn't really seem to be the answer because Yusuf, every time he landed a jab, he knocked Feely's head back 2 inches at least. So then there's this conversation about significant strikes, which my brother J.K. Atkins has never really liked. There's got to be some moment here where we have a conversation, though, about volume, which is important. I appreciate that style, versus damage. And I guess what kind of damage are we talking about? Damage that discontinues the fighter's ability to move on? Damage that essentially is cosmetic, right? Somebody could be bleeding and continue on and it does nothing. So what really was the deciding factor for me was when the grappling exchanges happened, Yusuf, if he initiated it, he won. If he didn't initiate it, even if he landed on his back or on the ground, he quickly moved into position and found himself on top, quickly threatened, always moved in and found himself applying a threat of a choke. In the post-fight interview, he even brings up his base is jiu-jitsu. He comes from a jiu-jitsu gym. Striking has come new to him, but he's had so much fireworks behind his hands. That's what was a deciding factor. And so that was pretty incredible. Obviously, my dog in this, you know, I was rooting for Yusuf on multiple levels. It's not only one of my fantasy league picks. I was really impressed with him last year. I believe it was UFC 242. And then also, I really see a door opening with him. With Africans climbing the ranks and becoming more champions, I think the effect of other individuals getting into MMA will change across the world. And more importantly, in this country. I think he, you know, when people like him and Usman and Adesanya continue to grab belts, it allows individuals to not only go off and be dentists, doctors, and lawyers, but high-level UFC fighters and realize that there is not one clinical definition of brilliance, that we can be amazing at so many things. The other one is really interesting to talk about. Mata Ferry versus Barber. You know, I said this all over social media and the podcast. I'm a huge fan of Mata Ferry, and it's personal to me. It's nearly emotional. You know, I've received a bunch of different honors in the sort of ecosystem around the UFC and the MMA. Things that just mean a lot to me, where fighters will say something to me or message me or just let me know, hey, I think the stuff that you do is really important and I appreciate it. I put up a clip of the show where I sort of called, I sort of mentioned that I was rooting for Roxanne Mata Ferry because she reminds me of what my mom would be if she was an MMA fighter. And I kind of thought of myself as an MMA mama's boy. And Roxanne reposted that to all her followers and said, well, that she took it as a compliment. And I was like, wow, that's huge. And I like to think I put a battery in her back because, boy, did she walk in there and beat the shit out of Macy Barber. Woo! I mean, I thought Barber was going to go in there and do deadly things to Roxanne, who was going to weather the storm but survive. Maybe win by decision, maybe lose because it was rough. But within the first round, you could tell Roxanne's hands had changed. She had worked and worked. And we knew that the jiu-jitsu was incredible. But she had worked at different levels. She had worked at different games. She was at a different place. And about after the sixth strike landed, she hit Macy so hard, it looked like she blew out her knee. Do I think that's what really happened? Probably not. Now let's go back. When's the last time we saw something like that? Tyron Woodley versus Carlos Condit. Tyron hit him so hard, the man's knee came unattached. Probably already a nagging injury that Carlos Condit had. And so with the power of the freight train that is Tyron Woodley, when it landed, it aggravated the injury. So I'm going to bet that Macy Barber went into there with that injury and believed that, you know, she was going to soldier up, go out on her shield, but she felt like she could go through and deal with the injury afterwards. I don't think she really saw Roxanne's power. I don't think Roxanne knew her power. She was just staying relaxed and cracking them. And I think a good example of those of you who are getting into boxing or getting into kickboxing and learning to strike is if you look at Roxanne's hands, her body does not, her body compared to Macy's does not have any power in it. You look at it and you're like, a little bit taller, but you know, she don't look like she could crack. The key is, when she snapped out that jab or that cross and it came right back to her chin and it was super relaxed, that's where the killers come from. That's where the power comes from. And that was very telling and that was very cool. I couldn't have been more impressed with Roxanne Mata Ferry. All the kudos to her. That was her fight to win. She earned it. She's definitely earned the respect. I saw some posts about how because of that fight, her dad will no longer ask her when she's going to retire. She has just been the comeback kid in so many levels, and this is just so real. I mean, you know, if she keeps this up, she's going to be a real threat and a contender, and I would be excited for that because, again, she embodies the best of what this sport's about. So I was super impressed. I'm going to take a bit of a break, and I'll be back with you later on. Cage Cousins, I'm back. A lot of thoughts. I just finished a hot yoga session. I'm just trying to get these in, these cool downs and these thoughts about UFC 246, McGregor versus Cerrone. I don't know how the sound quality is. I'm experimenting a lot with Anchor. I talk a lot, a good game about not letting good be the enemy of great. And I've never been sure about the sound quality of these, and that's what's kept me from doing them. So I think it's better that I try this and then learn than not. So feel free to comment. I'm only going to get better at this. I have a bad habit of, you know, I spend a lot of time driving between things that I own, businesses that I help or whatever, and I'm always on the phone with people. You know, I swear I taught that to Kevin Hart. So I figured I see everybody always do these videos and they're talking to their camera and y'all seem to like those. Y'all love those camera videos. Yo, this is what you need to do. I think that's the corniest junk ever. I'm not going to do those, but I'll at least walk you through some of these thoughts. So, yeah, I took a little break to go to my yoga class. I think yoga is a really good complement for martial arts. When I first started training, the Chinese martial arts that I did, yoga was mandatory. It was built into the class. One could even argue that some of our system, you know, like the muscle tendon changing classics, is yoga. But I find what it really does is it's good for the joints and the stabilizer muscles. And it loosens things up. And it takes, you know, if you take a lot of leg kicks, you're taking a lot of body shots, there's muscles that have sort of seized up on you. Yoga is incredible for fixing that, and especially the hot yoga makes it easy. And it's also really good for what I found is, you know, not giving up, because you just got to go through the class. And if you, you know, want to complain, you will complain. If you want to get through the class, you will find that. And that's that, you got to embrace the grind. So especially when I, you know, spar or do a lot of grappling in the summer and it's so hot, it's simulated to me by hot yoga. So that's my tangent for the day. So many other things to think about. The main card kicked off with Anthony Pettis versus Diego Ferreira, which is awkward that they would put that fight right there. And I'll come back to this. Given everything that we knew and the rising star, Macy Barber, I was wondering why that fight wouldn't have been there. But I understand that the prelims are a different product than the product that is being sold in the pay-per-view. So the idea being, when you turn on this pay-per-view, the first thing you should see is an electrifying fight with some kind of finish. And it reminds me of when I was 19 or 20, Brain and I, we used to watch a lot of Pride in the middle of the night, or we'd watch, you know, WWE or WCW pay-per-view, and they'd put the Lucha Libres or the sort of cruiserweights in the beginning because of the gymnastics. Later, that space became occupied by Dean Malenko and Chris Jericho, Perry Saturn, Chris Benoit. So Eddie Guerrero, you know, just high gymnastics, high flying, a lot of electricity kind of fights to bring in the casuals. I wonder if that was the plan to do it. It's weird because you have Anthony Pettis, who has had this strange parallel with Robert Whittaker. And what do I mean by that? Plagued by injuries that pull him out for a year to 2 years so he doesn't stay active, but he has a tremendous draw. And what do I mean by that? The entire country of Australia would seem to be in love with Robert Whittaker as a fighter. And I know this from an expert opinion because I'm married to a Kiwi and I am a Kiwi now, and I talk to a lot of Aussies. And if you guys don't know that, when it comes to sports, Kiwis and Aussies, they don't like each other. So when I see them at UFC events and you talk to them, they're all about the Reaper. But the entire population of the country of Australia could probably fit into the city of Los Angeles. Less than 10 million. So they really motivate. So what's that the equivalent of? Anthony Pettis, at the same time, with his draw, he really has brought back the energy and the focus and the, I don't know what I want to call it. There was a time when the Midwest was really showing up to UFC events because of Matt Hughes, because of Pat Miletich, because, believe it or not, Robbie Lawler, that camp, okay? And let's not forget, you know, Ace, you know, the middleweight champion. So, in my opinion, given the lineage that Pettis comes from of Rufus Sport, he has that ability to really turn the dial. He doesn't have to be in a Chicago or Wisconsin. I hate when I do those equivalents. How about Chicago or Milwaukee? Should be state to state and city to city. He doesn't have to be there to get a draw. People will fly to Vegas. And if you ever spend any time in Vegas, people from the Midwest are coming there anyways. So he's a draw. But his star, in my opinion, never climbed as high as it could be because he was always the victim of what I would call transitions. He made his staked his claim in the WCEC as their 155 champion, famously knocked out Benson Henderson with that Showtime kick, moved on, got ready to become the UFC champion, and was dealing with an injury. Came back, choked out Benson Henderson, took his belt back, left with an injury. Dominated a Wheatie box, never dominated the division the way he should have. Since then, in that same division, if you look at the people who were there, who really put a whooping on him, you have people like RDA, right? Who basically handed him his lunch. He has had great success at 170. And again, I keep alluding to this, that he took out Wonder Boy. And that's not really one of the only people to cleanly knock him out. But he also got his butt handed to him by Nate Diaz at 170. So it's a bit of a mystery. What's next for him? What does he do? Fajeda, on the other hand, is on an undefeated streak. Most people might, aside from the Texas crowd that was there, might be going, who is this guy? Why should I care? Do I care? Can I care? You have to care. Fajeda is a monster. But what he brought up is, again, he is an accomplished jiu-jitsu player. And it was really interesting. Adisa said, and I mentioned, Showtime Pettis just getting his black belt. And Adisa being like, you know, it's not clear to me that a belt in jiu-jitsu matters at all in MMA. I'm not clear that any belts matter. I think that's the history of UFC and MMA, is that you have these brothers who is coming up here, well, and some non-brothers calling themselves black belts in ninjutsu, black belts in this, and they couldn't handle. Golden glove boxers with one glove, they couldn't handle. And what that fight really revealed, it was kind of sad, but despite Pettis's superior striking, and what I mean by superior is he is able to throw his hands and add boxing to a Taekwondo skill set with you know, Muay Thai leg kicks. But it didn't matter. It sadly didn't matter. Because ultimately, when Fedele went for the single and grabbed it, he lifted Pettis up in the air. Pettis, strangely, sadly, ironically, you know, he had that look. And you could hear Felder kind of like, oh, great flexibility on the behalf of Pettis. But you had that look in Pettis' eye, which is, I've had this knee injury that's taken me out so many times before, I'm not willing to risk it one more time. And so he made the choice and gave up the takedown. Fedea ended up on his back, rear naked choke, and that ended it. So what's next for him? Will we see this man in UFC anymore? He's a draw. He brings in a female crowd. He definitely can make the money. But his competitiveness at a championship level is highly questionable. And what we saw, specialists in jiu-jitsu can invalidate his striking. Will these, you know, I hate to believe it, but it's just possible that his body has too much mileage on it. He has fought too many wars. And the new generation that's coming up doesn't have the same injuries. And they're bringing a level of specialization that's just invalidating his skill set. It'll be sad to see him go. I mean, his younger brother's already made the transition to Bellator. I could see, you know, I could see Pettis beating up Cans in Bellator. I could see him going to one. The question is, what does he see? Is it about the money? Is it about legacy? What's next? But I don't, sadly, I think his era is over. I don't see a deep competitive strain of a Pettis anymore in the UFC. And that's rough to say, you know, but again, I'm the guy who's trying to convince you of why you should watch his fights, not convince you that he's done. So, for my MMA brethren out there fighting, I think you know where I come from with this. You know, we got to just deal with the harsh realities and the facts. But I'm not interested in trying to hate or make fun of people unless you're Kobe Covington or Chael Sonnen. So, I mean, again, I'm still deeply confused about the allocation of the placement of this fight and why. But that was the first firework off the card. And we saw what happened. So, these next, fights, these next two are almost lazy booking. Am I ruining myself a job? Am I going to keep myself from getting something from these dudes, Sean Shelby and whatever? It's lazy booking, you know? It's kind of stereotypical. Odey Osborne versus Brian Keller. Maurice Green versus Alexei Olenek. Why do I bring that up? African-American kickboxers with no ground game versus seasoned grapplers who can prove that that doesn't matter. So here we go again. Didn't we just hear this fight? Wasn't this Ferreira versus Pettis? So let's start with Maurice Green. It's kind of funny. I was trying to explain to one of my coaches how Olenek is the master of the Ezekiel choke. And he's like, really? And I was like, yeah. He's like, got it off like six times. But yet the guy he's fighting is like a championship crochet guy. And he calls his back leg kick the crochet kick, right? So I'm trying to understand this. Like I'm thinking, I'm trying to put myself into those kicks. And that was Maurice Green and Olenek. I'm gonna jump back and forth. It started off with Osborne versus Keller. And Osborne, you know, had a great start, but unfortunately it was just very clear he threw fireworks at, let's say, 90%, and when they missed, Kelleher sort of gritted his teeth, bit into his mouthpiece, reached into his soul and said, I'm on a losing streak. I ain't going to lose my contract and my job. Close the distance, dip this fool, and then got the submission and choked him out, I think, less than 30 seconds. And it was just very evident that Kelleher had the experience. It's kind of funny. I realized to myself that Brian Kelleher kind of looks like the white Demetrius Johnson, but that's a conversation for another time. And I think the challenge with that is, you know, obviously I'm going to swap this guy. I swapped Osborne out of my fantasy because he cost me points. Makes me wonder, was this a boon to Boom? Was he put there because he's a real contender? Was he put there to kind of buy Brian some time because the boys in the top office like him? I don't know. It's easy to critique these fights when you're not in there. But fundamentally, one thing that has always frustrated me is tropes. And I'm going to talk about the two tropes that I hate and I've hated in MMA and martial arts for the longest time. The first trope is the cocky, explosive, African, Caribbean, African-American diaspora striker who does not invest in ground or grappling, who believes that his hands are so nasty, his feet, his kicks are so incredible. Dog, do you know how many knockouts I've had? He's done that stuff so much that he couldn't possibly ever go to the ground. So he just doesn't train it. It's disgusting. The other one is the wrestler who is incredible, who kind of feels like, I'm going to walk through shots and get over there. And once I get my hands on them, they're going to go to ground. And they never seem to have the cardio to follow up. So after the first takedown, they realize this ain't a wrestling match. This is MMA. I'm willing to bet there are non-black fighters, non-Latino fighters who are having these conversations. But I'm having the conversation. And when I see those tropes, it makes me sick. And again, I train people. I also am trained by people. So when I see somebody who's like, says these things, like, oh man, my style is going to prevent me from having to learn that other stuff. It's just ridiculous, and you kind of see it. And I wonder if that's some of the things going along with Osborne on that, because he looked very fish out of the water. And that's not to say that Kelleher didn't have that amazing level of takedown, but Osborne just looked scared. Then we go back to Green versus Olenek. Fight starts off, Olenek comes in, he's sort of like baiting some strikes to be thrown so he can sort of see the timing. Out of the gate, Green just throws that crochet kick to the back leg. Boom! It's great. It lands. It's wonderful. It's almost taking the base out of the wrestler, except he makes the fatal mistake. He doesn't move afterwards. He stands right in front of him. He stands right in front of him. Old Nick comes over, closes the distance, starts taking him down, and I'm surprised. I thought as soon as it went to the ground, Ezekiel Choke would be over. Maurice Green, I got to give you credit. I doubted your ability to survive one round on the ground with Olenek. But you did. It was almost reminiscent of Durandamé versus Nunes. Although Durandamé is a much better counter grappler. Second round comes in. The coaches tell Green, don't stand in front of him. Keep moving. Green starts the strikes, but surprise, surprise, the cardio isn't there. Why isn't the cardio there? These are heavyweights. These are heavyweights. What's the stereotype of heavyweights? Heavyweights don't really move, and the ones that do move, their bodies have trouble. Okay. The exception being the famous heavyweight champion, Cardio Cain Velasquez, and maybe one criticism might be, despite having the cardio, his stylistically, he felt his body, he worked his body like he was a 145er, and maybe his joints and his back couldn't really survive after doing that. So eventually, the submission comes in, Green is put out. Which is kind of disappointing. But again, I didn't pick him. And then this interesting statement. Olenek says at the post-fight, he says, you know, at my age, I should be in another league fighting, you know, cans who are older than me just trying to get a check. Bellator. But he's not there. And that's really interesting. And you got to remember, this guy is spends all his time around Andre Arlovsky. So I thought that took, you know, some revelation. I thought that took some self-awareness and some honesty. that the sport badly needs, and impressed me. So I think I would root for Oleynik in the future, and I always root for the old guys, but I think he recognizes, you know, I shouldn't even be here. And that was pretty impressive to me. Then we get to our co-main event of the evening, which some people question why this is happening. Holly Holm, the preacher's daughter, versus Raquel Rocky Pennington. To give background, as I previewed, you know, Holly Holm's rise in terms of taking out the tyrant and sort of founder of the UFC bantamweight division, Ronda Rousey, by tremendous knockout, which, you know, is not, you know, cannot be understated. It's an amazing accomplishment, but it also, in years after, we just have to be honest about the striking inferiority of Ronda Rousey, okay? That fundamentally, she just was not even a journeyman boxer or kickboxer. She was a judoka with an armbar and some setups for that. And I know what you're thinking for you seasoned cage cousins who've watched this. Well, I don't know if I believe that, sweet. I watched her put mitts on Betch Korea. Betch ain't that raw. Betch ain't fresh. Okay? So, Betch is maybe the same level as Rousey, if not worse, with her hands. And both of them have a tremendously bad habit of dropping their hands after they throw strikes. And doing that silly, ridiculous sort of pawing motion where they ask people to hit them harder. You know, like, come on, I can take it. No, you can't. So, Holly Holm clearly has been a champion at 35. And, you know, I got to go back and say, you know, this was somebody who was also a boxing champion. And Cejudo wanted to talk about, I'm the only person who's really been, you know, a champion in two sports. And made sure he glossed over Holly Holm, you know. And I'm not just saying that because of the prior years of sort of the tensions between JK and the Holm camp. I'm just telling facts, right? So if you look at Holly Holm's rise, and then later she fights against Duranda May in a fight that many argue she won, especially when you consider the after the bell strikes, it's arguable that Holm was at for some time the featherweight champion, which is the heavyweight division of the women's MMA and UFC, and you should credit her by that. She was robbed of that title because they are factually recorded after the bell strikes. So, unfortunately, her recent fight was her being knocked out by her very same back leg kick against Amanda Nunes, which was, you know, hard to watch, but also you gotta just, like, there it is, like, there's the template. If Ronda was the first, you know, to sort of, like, you know, in the same argument that one could say Hickson is the first jiu-jitsu MMA fighter, Hoist is, you know, in GOAT category for his ability to win two UFCs. And so, clearly, Amanda has established the metric for what you, when you talk about the greatest of all time and women's MMA, you're comparing everybody from this moment on to Amanda Nunes. Now, there's a couple challenges with this, and my own reasoning too. And to give you some background, there was a time when I was a very active battle MC competitively. And, you know, in my teenage years, this was about money or sort of like taking material objects from a guy from another high school. So that way they understood that my name rang out and that I was feared. Later, all that financial incentive removed and we battled people to get on their shows. And I guess famously, some of you guys who know my background, me and my partner, Merce, were pretty relentless about running up on 27-year-old men when we were 19, challenging them and stealing their stage time to prove that, you know, we had something, we were bringing something to the table. Later, those kind of leagues have evolved into things where people can put up money and it's competitive. I still have never seen a criteria, and I'm always suspicious about, well, what does the crowd say and what does the judge say? Like, MMA has the same problem, and it has a judging rubric. Grind time, smack, all these things. Where's the judging rubric? Why is there not an app? So that always makes me suspicious. The reason why I bring that up in terms of battling and why that relates is one of the challenges in there is, you know, some people used to say, you know, well, that's Lauryn Hill is Lauryn Hill and MC Light are the illest female MCs ever to battle. And then there's a couple problems with that statement. The first one is, do you have any documentation of their battles, or did they write really hard rhymes that aimed at people? I think historically, the only real documented battle of the golden era is Roxanne Shanté when she's dissing on records. You know, MC Light was just serving any man who wanted to say a woman couldn't rap, and Lauryn Hill was never open about the people she was dissing, but most of the time it was J. Rue the Damager or Tupac or whatever, but she never put names out there, right? The major challenge with that statement for me is women's MC. So here's where we go with this. Women's MMA. You know, there's a lot of reasons to separate those out, and I'm going to probably get myself in a pitfall with this because we're at this place in time with social justice where we are at a sort of on the road to liberation. We may have stopped at a bus station that we need to work out some stuff that in my mind may not be the number one priority. And so in one place you see all these young people who are born one gender wanting to do athletics in another gender that they identify with. And I personally don't really care or have any problem with them identifying with a separate gender. What I do care about is, and I'm not the only person to say it, is people who were biologically born as a male, and I don't know why that's a debate, but I have learned in my own experiences with things that people may not like the science, and then they find a couple scientists or an era of science that may have some problematic or racial issues, and then that's where they start deciding that all science is racist or all science is sexist. So there is a justification that thought that somebody who was born as a male should be able to fight in women's MMA. I find that disgusting. And what I find about it disgusting is the muscle composition, the bone density. It's just different. When you watch a 145-pound woman, okay? Or let's just take it back down. Let's take 135, okay? Amanda Nunes. Jermaine Demandami. And you compare him to 145 or 135 fighter, Henry Cejudo. Their bodies look different. The techniques are different. There's a reason why. It's a proven fact. We learn this, you know, as martial artists. You understand. There's an equal distribution of muscle across the woman's body. That's probably why they're stylistically more technical, because they move full body. Men tend to have a little bit load up on the top of their body. That's why you see people wing punches. You see guys who have just got a heavy haymaker and they fatigue. Most women don't have that luxury because they don't have that right arm that they could set up that way. So women's MMA, you have to separate it by weight. To make it MMA, you have to separate women because women can't fight men because of the body differences. And then you also, we're talking about, you know, different eras of MMA. So I think women's MMA is maybe 6 years old, where, you know, MMA as it's done now by weight division, let's say 2005 is when sort of the sale, the first acquisition of the UFC to set up a regulated. So not really an apples to apples conversation, but if we could go back there and say it, I would have to argue that maybe if there were candidates to be put into greatest of all time, obviously it's Amanda Nunes. I would say you could probably make a good argument that Holly Holmes, her ability, and I did the black person that had an S on the end, Holly Holmes. You could argue that Holly Holmes should be in that conversation too, given not only her activities in combat sports, in two separate combat sports, but her ability to almost, she's like double champ with the asterisk. So, these are two concepts. So, in addition to that, let's talk about Raquel Pennington, her opponent, who is not only the training partner of Tisha Torres, her wife, who is a strawweight contender, but in addition to that, Raquel Pennington spent a lot of time at American Top Team with Amanda Nunes. She also spent a lot of time with Amanda Nunes' partner, Nina Ansaroff. Why is this relevant? Why are we bringing this up? Why is this important? My prediction was that Raquel Pennington, who has made a run at the title similar to Holly Holm, did not get knocked out. She went up to war with Amanda Nunes, did not get knocked out, took a lot of damage, survived, went for 5 rounds. There might be some intangibles in there, that these two training partners were equally, a little bit more equally matched, or maybe because of Amanda's love for her homegirl, she didn't go in as hard, right? This is maybe the brown belt versus the purple belt kind of lesson. I'm going to get paid to school you on pay-per-view, but I'm certainly not going to take you out and humiliate you or expose you. So anybody else who wants to know how to defeat you can do so. Yet and still, I don't think she did her any favors. And that showed up in the fight Saturday night. Because not only did Raquel Pennington look over home and assume that she was fighting the same Holly, who had no grappling anymore, and had a game plan that just simply did not work. Holly clearly watched with her coaches this battle that Amanda and Rocky had, and had a great game plan. It was almost scary to and sad if you're a Pennington fan to watch the same game plan that that, you know, had been successful against neutralizing Pennington be employed by Holm against her. What do I mean by that? Holly Holm's a boxer. And we all know for a long time her weakness was grappling. But she looked to out-wrestle Pennington, who's supposed to be the better wrestler. It was scary. It was sad. So it's disappointing on two levels. I don't know if there's anywhere else for Pennington to go. She may just stay the number three in the bantamweight division. We'll have to see how this plays out. But she's certainly not going to be the gatekeeper number one, because that's Holm's spot. Holm is making a compelling argument that maybe in two more fights, she could run at Amanda again, that she's learned some lessons. But in their exchange, it wasn't that Amanda slammed her down and choked her out the way that, you know, Cookie did. Cookie Monster. Not at all. Or excuse me, not Cookie Monster, except, what's her name? Cupcake, Misha Tate. But instead, she knocked her clean out. So I would have to argue, you would have to see in my mind as a fan to get interested, I'd have to see Holm knock out two more people with some leg strikes to go, okay, now we got a battle, right? Now we got a battle. So that's the first disappointment of losing the competitive nature of Pennington. The other disappointment is I have to become a Holly Holm fan again. And I had some closure on that after she got knocked out by Nunes and said, you know what? Okay. I like the way this woman throws her hands. It reminds me of myself, but simply, it's clear that she has a weakness when it comes to kickboxers. And, you know, and also, she stands a little too close to John Jones. Same camp, you know, and I'm a little bit old school like that. The company you keep tells me everything, right? So on a positive level, I always loved Rashad Evans. When he left Jackson Winklejohn, I was like, y'all dead to me. Y'all the enemy. When he found Rumble Johnson, I was about that and still am. When he was talking about his sort of protege, Kamaru Usman, I was an early fan. Now look at it. The reverse is true. It's no secret. I think John Jones might be one of the worst things to happen to MMA, aside from Conor McGregor. So if you hang out together, you know, it tells me something about that. So you just got to stop and wait and be a little bit patient. Hold on, see what's going to happen. But it is what it is. So that's that fight. Over three rounds, Raquel Pennington was deeply neutralized, marginalized, and cauterized. She got everything except for a black eye. Maybe the last 20 seconds, Pennington was losing the clinch. I could say maybe it was I would looked at the fight differently if it was a five-round fight. And from rounds three to four, the clinch started working for Pennington, but it just wasn't. And so that one's in the books, and we have to move past it. So now we get to the main events of the evening, McGregor versus Donald Cerrone. I guess I should say the notorious Conor McGregor versus Cowboy Donald Cerrone. The conversation is really about strategy versus tactics. I saw a great post by Robin Black on his Instagram, and he talked about strategy and tactics, and I wanted to challenge some of his notions a little bit of it. And that's not the same as, you know, I think what troubles me in today's social media culture is people don't understand that debate and diversity of opinion gets us better to ideas, and that the ideas get better fleshed out. So it's when you hear a challenge, people just always beat you up because you're not having a monolithic opinion. So I watch all these 20-year-olds, and they're very interested in drag and cancel culture, but they're not really trained to have good, attributed, vigorous debates. I'm very different in that way. I was raised by a civil rights attorney and a woman who studied statistics. And so I'm a big fan of trying to put together ideas and test it. And that's why I love mixed martial arts, because it ultimately says one person's program versus another, and we will see truth somewhere in between. And that's some deep sort of spiritual concepts as well. So looking at that, thinking about that, Robin Black talked about the strategy versus the tactics that was really employed in McGregor's victory. I really think that we want to talk about it, what happened, the fight, and we'll go play by play, and that we'll talk about the tactics. I will talk about the strategy after that for both fighters and for the organization, because it's actually more of a business thing. Tactics, the bell rings, both fighters match up. You know, obviously this is a huge draw. Both fighters match up. It starts. McGregor comes in with his southpaw stance, which is probably not actually his real stance. It's what he's adjusted to. And he comes in and he throws that sort of quick hook from the front hand, from his right hand, from, you know, almost reminiscent of Roy Jones Jr. Surprise, surprise, Cowboy Cerrone, a consummate, educated, well-thought kickboxer, ducks under and initiates the clinch. So you think to yourself, every person who has faced McGregor has had three scenarios. A striking war. Has anybody won a striking war with McGregor? Only really one, in my opinion. Khabib Nurmagomedov has been the only person to really lock down this guy. Now, I know what you're thinking, Cage Cousins. Nate Diaz choked this guy out. Yeah, he was touching him up on his feet. And yeah, McGregor initiated the takedown, which is ultimately his demise. So you can't really call that a striking match. And then the second time they fought each other, he kept knocking down Nate Diaz. We will not be able to understand what that fight will look like or who won that rivalry until the third fight, if there is a third fight. And then we can, and if those fights stay completely standing, at least we could say out of two exchanges that were all standing, we know who the victor is. So after the clinch is engaged, strangely, Cerrone does not go anywhere else. He's studying McGregor. I'm trying to think about the times I've seen McGregor down. Obviously, Khabib Nurmagomedov just manhandled him like he did everybody else. Chad Mendes got him down and really did not look like he had an ability to do anything to McGregor on the ground. I think in the past I've said that I feel like the McGregor Chad Mendes fight was fixed. I just said that because I was dumbfounded that somebody in Mendes's wrestling caliber who could do such powerful clinches to Aldo really could not keep McGregor, could not ground and pound him out. I just don't get that, and then let him up. And there's a lot of other factors, and it's also probably really a mistake to be so critical of Mendes when I myself am not a UFC fighter with a contract who is in contention for a belt. So I'll leave it there. But Cerrone, for his wrestling caliber, you would think, okay, I got the clinch. I must have drilled this enough, right? I come under the hook. I get the clinch. Boom, takedown, right? Boom. You know, we're going to train that over and over again. Boom. No, he just sits and waits. Is he trying to throw a knee? Is it going to be an elbow? Are we going to do Muay Thai? And out of nowhere, McGregor starts popping him right in the nose, right in the face with a shoulder. Shoulder one, Cerrone doesn't answer. Shoulder two, Cerrone doesn't answer. Shoulder three, Cerrone's nose is a gusher. I'm gonna come back to this nose. Cerrone tries to get some space because he's hurt. McGregor follows up with a head kick. Clips him. Lovely. Puts him against the cage. McGregor pounds him out. Has a 170 victory. Starts talking a bunch of trash. I'll deal with it in a minute. Let's deal with the first fact here. So that's the tactics. The tactics were beautifully employed. He fought the perfect game plan against Cerrone. Let's talk about the strategy. There's no official tune-up fight in the UFC. There's absolutely no such official concept. One of the suspicions that Brain and I have had since the sale is that older fighters get younger fighters because it's a double booking. If the older fighter can use their experience to outdo the younger fighter, it's a tune-up fight. If the younger fighter takes out the older guy, at least he climbs the ranks. So it's a tune-up fight either way. I've seen that strategy, and I would argue that this was a tune-up fight. There's no disrespect to Donald Cerrone. I'm actually a really big fan. But McGregor needed a win in the UFC to deal with his disaster against Khabib, and he really needed to make an argument. So at 170, where he doesn't have to cut weight, he's bigger, he's more stronger, he made sure he got the most broken dude to fight. Okay, so first of all, he wants to make money. So he gets the headline of pay-per-view and it's not for a belt. He fights Cerrone and it becomes a sponsorship war between Budweiser, which is the official sponsor of Donald Cerrone, and Proper 12. So even with Modelo and all the other brands of the UFC all over the cage, you still see Proper 12. And when guys are there at Las Vegas, when girls are watching the fight, they're not ordering Modelos at the MGM or whatever, or the T-Mobile Stadium. They're going to have stadium drinks, which is Budweiser. This is a huge win-win from a money standpoint. I think Cerrone, what did I learn? 200 to show up, K that is, 200 to win. Well, he only got 200K, and that's not even the pay-per-view buys. Guaranteed, McGregor's going to get $3 million just by being there. Now that he won, of course, a bunch of them. So this works. McGregor's only going to fight people who brings people to the dance. The red penny night, as he calls it. But the strategy of, it's almost as if McGregor had either A, studied a bunch of footage of Cerrone, which is probably likely, or B, had an inside line to understand what is Cerrone's weaknesses. One could go back and think about their fight at the press conference, their little verbal war, where he told him he was too stiff, right? I didn't see any stiffness. In fact, McGregor looked a little stiff. Cerrone fundamentally was not ready after he'd done the clinch. It was like he got a technique off and he didn't know what to do. He didn't have any answer for the shoulder strikes, even though he put his head right there. This was something that McGregor had definitely trained for. And I, again, I'm very conflicted and I feel bad criticizing, but I think the mistake was ultimately in Cerrone getting that clinch and not being able to immediately follow up to the takedown. That was his doom. It was clear to me that McGregor knew that was coming. Whether that was a Belichick moment and that he was told that was something Cerrone was training, right? Whether it was at the PI or whatever. Whether he just saw old footage, whether he bought a spy, whatever. He just knew. He knew what Cerrone was going to do before Cerrone knew what he was going to do, and that just played out. And there was really no answer. The frustration that I have is for people who have never seen the shoulder strike, this is a tactic that Anderson Silva has used several times. So it's part of Muay Thai. It's not something McGregor invented, okay? Kind of really disappointing. I think Cerrone could have had it in the bag. But also, we'll come back to the nose. Why the nose? The last time, let's look at Cerrone. Cerrone takes fights too quickly. He doesn't take time to recover. He'll fight anyone, everywhere. His body's broken. People think that's part of his mystique. Clearly not. That nose, last summer, was swole the F up when he saw Tony Ferguson. It's not going to heal in a year. And then he just got the same shot from his good friend Justin Gaethje in the nose that shut him down. So McGregor knew. Take the nose, you take Cerrone. Clear as day. Very sad to see. Now we have to deal with more McGregor. What's the next fight that we get to see? I suspect McGregor is going to argue for a Khabib fight. This is very interesting because this works really well because I don't see Khabib winning against Ferguson. Yeah, I said it again. So Ferguson wins, which is great. He gets to see the number one contender in Gaethje, and then McGregor and Khabib get to run it back, which is interesting. Also, of course, somewhere in the 170, there's got to be a Nate Diaz trilogy. And so I could also see McGregor challenging for the BMF, which is really the 175 belt, and they're just not being honest about it. So I'd love to hear your thoughts, Cage Cousins. I hope the sound and all these thoughts worked for you. I'm trying my best here. I just want to keep the content consistent. Take care. Again, this is the programmable animal himself, Sweet NBA. Have a good day.